Living with Kindness, the Buddha's Teaching on Metta by Sangha Ratchita. Preface. When the Dalai Lama was recently asked about the nature of his beliefs as a Buddhist, he replied, "My religion is kindness." And there can be few Buddhists who would argue with that as a soundbite definition of Buddhism. So how can this rather humdrum response form the basis of a religious faith? The quality he referred to as kindness is indeed central to all forms of Buddhism. But most Buddhists prefer to use the more precise and penetrating traditional term for it, Maitri in Sanskrit, or Metta in Pali. What really distinguishes Metta from what we usually think of as basic human kindness is that Metta is a quality developed through practice, specifically the practice of the Metta Bhavana meditation, the cultivation of universal loving kindness. As such, Metta is potentially boundless in its scope. There is no limit to how far you can take it. At the same time, Metta is always rooted in that basic quality of ordinary human kindness. Just to reach out of one's self-absorption, however momentarily, and connect with the life around one, is to muster the basic ingredients one needs to perform this meditation. The cultivation of the inner life can become somewhat self-referential, if not alienating, without this practice. And as Sangha Ratchita emphasizes in the pages that follow, it is effective only if it translates back into ordinary human kindness. Sangha Ratchita himself is certainly well qualified to talk about metta, both in its theory and its practice. Throughout his life, he has read widely, studied assiduously, and reflected deeply. At the same time, despite his personal inclination to a life of quiet reflection and study, he has always worked for the welfare of others, both in India, especially with Dr. Ambedkar's mass conversion movement of ex-untouchables in the 1950s, and in the West, with his founding of the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. It is always hard to pin a Buddhist down to anything like a credo. Sangha Ratchita would, for example, probably differ from the Dalai Lama on one or two issues. However, he long ago made a clear statement of his faith, in which he can be seen to follow very much the same spiritual impulse that the Dalai Lama would one day acknowledge as the key principle of his own life, encapsulated in the idea of metta. In a booklet published in 1986, Sangha Ratchita writes, "I believe that humanity is basically one. I believe that it is possible for any human being to communicate with any other human being, to feel for any other human being, to be friends with any other human being. This is what I truly and deeply believe. This belief is part of my own experience. It is part of my own life. It is part of me. I cannot live without this belief, and I would rather die than give it up. For me, to live means to practice this belief." We have assembled this book mostly from the transcript of a seminar on the Karaniya Metta Sutta, the classic Buddhist text on the subject of metta, led by Sangha Ratchita in July 1978 at Padmaloka Retreat Center. As usual, with books compiled from Sangharakshita's lectures and seminars, we have deliberately retained Sangharakshita's relaxed delivery in order to make a clear contrast with the literary finish of his written work. The reader should bear in mind that while Sangharakshita still checks and corrects the books that are published in this way, the result is nothing like a book he would have written in the subject himself. The emphases are inevitably determined by the seminar participants and their particular concerns. Equally inevitably, the discussion is more discursive than one would normally expect from a book written in the usual way. However, it is probably true to say that Sangharakshita's boldest and most radical teaching is contained in his lectures and seminars. This is certainly where he has made his greatest impact on the lives of ordinary people, both in India and in the West. And there is always the added bonus of the anecdotes he draws from his colourful life or his very wide reading. There are many English translations of the Karaniya Metta Sutta available today, including a poetic rendering by Sangharakshita himself. However, when the seminar was conducted, there were a limited number to choose from. F. L. Woodward had produced both a prose version and one in blank verse, and there was also a translation by Robert Chalmers in print. The one used in this seminar was by Saditasa. In common with Woodward's approach, Saditasa's language follows the usual custom of his time with regard to translations of Buddhist texts, in being archaic and dignified in its vocabulary and rhythms, without detracting from the simplicity and clarity of this beautiful sutta. The editors are grateful to Vidya Devi, Kemavira, Dhammasura and Leah Morin for invaluable assistance in moving this book towards publication. Jinananda and Pavadana, in June 2004. The Karaniya Metta Sutta. He who is skilled in his good, who wishes to attain that state of calm, nirvana, should act thus. He should be able, upright, perfectly upright, of noble speech, gentle and humble, contented, easily supported with few duties, of light livelihood, with senses calmed, discreet, not impudent, not greedily attached to families. He should not pursue the slightest thing for which otherwise men might censure him. May all beings be happy and secure. May their hearts be wholesome. Whatever living beings there be, feeble or strong, tall, stout or medium, short, small or large, without exception, seen or unseen, those dwelling far or near, those who are born or those who are to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, nor despise any person whatsoever in any place. Let him not wish any harm to another, out of anger or ill will. Just as a mother would protect her only child at the risk of her own life, even so, let him cultivate a boundless heart towards all beings. Let his thoughts of boundless love pervade the whole world, above, below and across, without any obstruction, without any hatred, without any enmity. whether he stands, walks, sits or lies down, as long as he is awake, he should develop this mindfulness. This, they say, is the noblest living here. Not falling into wrong views, being virtuous and endowed with insight, by discarding attachment to sense desires, never again is he reborn. Introduction. The meaning of metta. The great secret of morals is love, or a going out of our own nature, and an identification of ourselves with the beauty which exists in thought, action or person, not our own. A man, to be greatly good, must imagine intensely and comprehensively. He must put himself in the place of another and of many others. The pains and pleasures of his species must become his own. The question of happiness, or the problem of unhappiness, is fundamental to Buddhism. If we could be sure that we would never experience sorrow or disappointment, we would have no need of the Buddha's teaching. But, things being as they are, we need to find a way to deal with our human predicament. This is what the Buddha taught himself to do, and succeeded in doing. Having solved the problem himself, he spent the rest of his life explaining to others the nature of the solution and how it is to be achieved. The Buddha's problem-solving approach finds expression in one of his most famous teachings, that of the Four Noble Truths, a teaching which offers a kind of blueprint for Buddhist practice. The first of these truths states quite simply that unhappiness exists as a feature of human experience. This is to state the obvious, no doubt. But the second noble truth, the cause of suffering, gives more food for thought. The essential cause of suffering, the Buddha says, is craving, the natural but painful desire for things to be other than as they are. If we can let go of that desire, if we can accept the rise and fall of experience as it is, not just in our heads, but in our heart of hearts, the problem of suffering will be solved. Of course, this is far easier said than done, but it can be done. The third noble truth is the truth of nirvana, the truth that the end of suffering can be achieved. Not through elevation to some heavenly state in some other place or time, but in this life, through one's own efforts to transform one's experience. What the Buddha is saying is that every human being has the capacity to become not just happy, but enlightened. The figure of the Buddha himself, the man Siddhartha, whose own spiritual progress is charted in the texts of the Pali Canon, is the enduring example of such self-determination. He embodied the sublime potential that can be activated in the human mind when it is turned resolutely towards the positive. The method of this transformation is outlined in the fourth of the Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path, each step of which, all the way to enlightenment, is based on the truth of conditionality, the principle of cause and effect that underlies every aspect of the Buddhist approach to human growth and development. All things change, as we know to our sorrow, but this very fact becomes the source of joy when we realize that we ourselves have the power to change ourselves and our experience. People sometimes prefer to think of Buddhism as a philosophy, or even a system of rational thought, rather than a religion. Buddhism does not, after all, rely upon divine aid as the means to happiness, but instead emphasizes the value of transforming one's experience in the light of a clear understanding of the nature of change. As such, it is a highly systematic teaching. But if we are not careful, we can end up thinking of the Buddha as a rather scholarly, intellectual, delivering lists of terms and definitions, an image which does not do justice either to the depth of his wisdom, which goes beyond words and terms, nor to the all-embracing breadth of his compassion. There are some forms of Buddhism in which a somewhat cerebral idea of the Buddha persists, and in which, consequently, little emphasis is placed on the emotional aspect of the Buddhist life. One might get the idea that we are supposed to keep our emotions firmly in check and concentrate on applying logic if we were to pursue insight into the nature of reality. There may even emerge a picture of the ideal Buddhist as someone who has gone beyond any kind of emotion, as though all strong emotions were unspiritual or even unethical. And this view does suit some people. But a close look at the early Buddhist works reveal a different picture. Throughout the ancient scriptures of the Pali Canon, it is made clear that the way to enlightenment involves the cultivation of the emotions at every step, most often in the form of the four Brahma Viharas, bracket. The Pali words can be translated as sublime abidings, close brackets. This series of meditations is designed to integrate and refine one's emotional experience so as to produce four different but closely related emotions: metta, or loving-kindness; mudita, or sympathetic joy; karuna, or compassion; and upeccha, or equanimity. Metta is the foundation of the other three Brahma Viharas. It is positive emotion in its purest, strongest form. In this book, we will be exploring in detail the Buddha's account of how this positive emotion is to be cultivated, as laid out in a text called the Karinaya Metta Sutta. But first, let us examine the term metta itself a little more closely. Of course, an emotion cannot be conveyed fully by verbal explanation, though poetry sometimes comes close to doing so. Then we have the added complexity of translation, as there is no exact English equivalent to the Pali word metta. But nonetheless, let us try at least to get a sense of the nature of this very special emotion. An ardent goodwill. Any friendly feeling, any friendship, contains the kernel of metta, a seed that is waiting to develop when we provide it with the right conditions. The Pali word metta, Maitri in Sanskrit, is related to mitta, Sanskrit mitra, which means friend. Metta can thus be translated as friendliness or loving kindness. Developed to its full intensity, metta is a down-to-earth care and concern directed to all living beings equally, individually, and without reservation. The unfailing sign of metta is that you are deeply concerned for the well-being, happiness and prosperity of the object of your metta, be that a person, an animal, or any other being. When you feel metta for someone, you want them to be not just happy, but deeply happy. You have an ardent desire for their true welfare, an undying enthusiasm for their growth and progress. The friendliness of metta doesn't necessarily involve actual friendship in the sense of a personal relationship with the person to whom you are directing it. Metta can remain simply an emotion. It doesn't need to become a relationship. Nevertheless, when you feel metta, you will want to go out to other beings, to help them and express goodwill towards them in everyday practical ways. And thus friendships can easily develop out of metta. If two people develop metta towards each other, their metta is likely to blossom into a true friendship, a friendship with a difference. The same goes for an existing friendship into which an element of metta is introduced. The metta will tend to take the self-interest out of the friendship, so that it becomes something more than the cheery camaraderie or emotional dependency that is the basis for most ordinary friendships. Friendship infused with metta becomes Kalyana Mitrata, spiritual friendship, which flourishes not on the basis of what each party gets out of the relationship, but by virtue of the mutual desire for the other's well-being that flows unreservedly in both directions. Thus, there is no rigid distinction to be drawn between worldly friendliness, or the worldly friendships that may come out of it, and metta. As we shall see, in its most highly developed form, metta is akin to insight into the very nature of things, insight with a capital I, as I sometimes say. But as a developing emotion, it remains for a very long time more akin to ordinary friendliness. Metta is a friendliness as we know it, carried to a far higher pitch of intensity than we are used to. In fact, it is friendliness without any limit whatsoever. Metta is present in the feeling you have for your friends, but it includes the intention continually to deepen and intensify whatever element of disinterested goodwill there is within it. Any friendly feeling, any friendship, contains the kernel of metta, a seed that is waiting to develop when we provide it with the right conditions. There is, by definition, something active about metta. We call it a feeling, but it is more precisely described as an emotional response or volition, rather than a feeling in the sense of a pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral sensation. This distinction between a feeling and an emotion is a basic Buddhist teaching. It includes the desire to act on our positive feelings, to do something practical to help the object of our metta to be happy, to look after their welfare and encourage their growth and progress, so far as lies in our power. As well as friendliness, therefore, metta includes the active, outgoing sense of goodwill or benevolence. So why don't we just translate metta as love? Love, especially romantic or parental love, can have the intensity and strength to move mountains. And this vigorous concern is one of the most important characteristics of metta. The problem with the word love is that it can be applied to almost anything that takes your fancy, including simple objects of appetite. You love your children or your boyfriend, but also the scent of an orange blossom and many more things besides. Metta, on the other hand, is directed only towards living beings. Moreover, when it is based on appetite or possessiveness, love always has the potential to turn sour, because that appetite may be thwarted, that possession may be taken away. The feelings of jealousy or resentment that derive from romantic, that is to say, dependent, love, can be more powerful than the most positive feelings of love in full bloom. Even parental love can turn bitter when it is felt to be unreciprocated, when one's child's ingratitude is sharper than a serpent's tooth, as Shakespeare's King Lear describes it. An ecstatic energy. Metta is blissful, ecstatic, a naturally expansive desire to brighten the whole world, the whole universe, and universes beyond that. While being careful to differentiate metta from all sorts of other emotions, we need not be so precious about it that we refine it out of existence. In the Ivivutaka, a collection of sayings from the Pali Canon, there is a passage in which the Buddha says of metta that it, inverted commas, burns and shines and blazes forth, close inverted commas, suggesting that it is closer to incandescent passion than what we usually think of as, inverted commas, spiritual, close inverted commas, emotion. The English terms friendliness, loving-kindness, and goodwill don't come close to expressing this sort of intensity and expansive energy. Indeed, the words we tend to use for the more spiritual emotions, that is, the more refined and positive ones, are usually understood in a rather weak sense. For example, the words refinement and purity, which refer to the quality of being free from impurities, and in that sense concentrated or powerful, suggest quite the opposite, something effete and diluted. When it comes to the more positive spiritual emotions, words seem to fail us. By contrast, our words for harmful and unrefined emotions, hatred, anger, jealousy, fear, anguish, despair, make a much more vivid and powerful impression. Metta, as I have described it, may seem pure rather than cool, aloof and distant, more like moonlight than sunshine. We tend to have the same sort of idea of angels. These celestial beings, for all their purity, usually come across as rather weak and lacking in energy by comparison to devils, who tend to be both physically and spiritually powerful and full of vigour. Rather like the angelic realm, metta, or loving-kindness, is for most people ultimately just not very interesting. This is because it is difficult to imagine developing positive emotion to anything like the degree of intensity of one's experience of the passions. We rarely purely experience positive emotion that is also strong. If we do experience any really intensive emotions, there is usually an element of possessiveness or aversion or fear in it somewhere. It is not easy to get rid of emotional negativity and develop the strong and vigorous positive emotion that is true metta. To do so, we have somehow to bring to the refined and balanced emotion of universal goodwill the degree of energy and intensity of lower, coarser emotions. To begin with, we have to acknowledge that this goes against the grain. If we are to do justice to metta as an ideal, We have to be realistic about the kind of strong emotion we actually experience. It may seem strange, but this is the basis upon which a higher emotional synthesis may be achieved. In our desire to be near the object of our passion, in our need to possess it and our longing for it to be a part of us, we experience the energy and intensity that will eventually characterize our experience of metta. Similarly, when we achieve the object of our passion, we may, for a brief moment, experience the blissful calm, the balance and harmony that also characterizes the genuine metta state. Metta brings together the contrasting emotional reactions of dynamic energy and calm repletion into a single quality of emotion, completely transforming them in the process. Although, when it is fully developed, metta is a feeling of harmony, both in oneself and with all beings, it also has a fiery, full-blooded, even ecstatic quality. Ecstasy literally means a sense of standing outside oneself, and this is how metta can feel. It is marked by such an intensity of positive emotion. When purely felt, it can carry you outside yourself. Metta is blissful, ecstatic, a naturally expansive desire to brighten the whole world, the whole universe, and universes beyond that. A rational emotion. When we think of others, the most reasonable response is that of metta. Metta is clearly a good thing in itself, but there is another reason to practice it, apart from its obvious merits as a very positive state of mind. It makes clear sense in terms not only of subjective feeling, but also of objective fact. This is brought out very clearly by the philosopher John McMurray. He distinguishes, first of all, between intellect and reason, designating reason as the higher or integrated and integrating faculty. Reason, he says, is that within us which is adequate to objective reality. When reason, thus defined, enters into intellect, you have an intellectual understanding that is adequate or appropriate to the objective situation, to reality. This definition of reason comes very close to the Buddhist understanding of prajna, or wisdom. Next, he goes on to point out that reason may be applied not only to intellectual understanding, but also to emotion. A brief example should illustrate the point. If, when you see a small spider, you fly into a panic, jump up and run to the other end of the room, this is an irrational reaction. The emotion is not appropriate to the object, because the spider is not really harmful. But when reason, as defined above, enters into emotion, your emotional responses will be adequate or appropriate to the objective situation, the real situation. We can see metta in the same way. Unlike emotions like mistrust, resentment, and fear, metta is the appropriate and adequate response to other human beings when we meet or think of them. That is, metta is a rational emotion. When we think of others, the most reasonable response is that of metta. We will wish all other beings happiness and freedom from fear, just as we wish ourselves these things. to understand that one is not so very different from any other human being, and that the world does not revolve around oneself, is an example of an intellectual understanding that is adequate to reality. To proceed from such a basis provides an appropriate foundation for our interactions with others. Metta is the norm or measure of our human response to others. This term, inverted commas, norm, close inverted commas, does not mean average or ordinary. It is closer in meaning to words like template or pattern or model. It is an ideal to which one seeks to conform. It is in this sense that Carolyn Rees Davies and others, early Western Buddhist scholars of Buddhism, sometimes translated Dharma as the norm. For all its shortcomings, this translation does bring out a sense of the Buddha's teachings as being the template of the spiritual life. Likewise, in the true sense of the word normal, a normal human being is someone who accords with the norm for humanity. And a normal human response is the response to be extracted from that positive, healthy, properly developed, balanced human being. Metta is the response to be expected, as it were, from one human being encountering another. There has to be that fellow feeling if we are to experience our humanity to the full. It is what Confucius called jian, or human-heartedness, the appreciation of our common humanity and the behaviour or activity that is based on that feeling. Metta is an emotional response to others that is appropriate to reality, and to that extent it has the nature of insight. That insight is likely to be fairly mundane to begin with, insight with a small I, one may say. But eventually it can become insight with a capital I, pranya, or wisdom in the full sense. In other words, through the development of metta, you eventually transcend the subject-object duality. And this is the ultimate goal of the wisdom seeker. The Sublime Abidings. Metta is the synthesis of reason and emotion, right view and skillful action, unobstructed spiritual vision and the bliss of a warm and expansive heart. In cultivating metta, we are trying to develop what one might call the higher emotions, that is, those emotions that provide us with a means of bringing together our everyday consciousness and something more purely spiritual. Without such a possibility, we have no way of approaching either the higher ranges of meditative experience called dhyana or enlightenment itself. It is as though metta, in the sense of an ordinary positive emotion, stands midway between the worldly and the spiritual. First, we have to develop metta in ways we can understand, just ordinary friendliness. And from there, we can begin to take our emotions to a far higher degree of intensity. As should by now be clear, metta, in the true sense, is different from ordinary affection. It isn't really like the love and friendliness we are used to. It is much more positive and much more pure. It is easy to underestimate metta and think of it as being rather cosy and undemanding. It is difficult, after all, to conceive what it is really like. Only when you have felt it can you look back to your previous emotional experience and realize the difference. The same goes for each of the four Brahma Viharas. When we begin to cultivate compassion, for example, we have to take whatever seed of it we can find within ourselves and help it to grow. As time goes by, our experience of it will deepen, and if our efforts to develop it are accompanied by a keen appetite for studying the Dharma and a willingness to bring our ideals into our everyday activity, we can come to experience a very pure, positive compassion, which is quite different from what we usually understand by the term. In the same way, the pure experience of sympathetic joy, mudita, is, because of its intensity, entirely different from the ordinary pleasure we might take in knowing that somebody else is doing well. Upekkha, equanimity, is a spiritual quality of a particularly elevated kind. There are traces of it in ordinary experience, perhaps in the tranquility that can be found in nature, in the experience of standing alone in a forest when the air is still and the trees stand silently around you. But upekkha goes far beyond even that kind of stillness. It has an intense, definite, even dynamic character of its own. And that is only to describe upekkha in its mundane sense. The fully developed Brahma-vihara is peacefulness of an indescribably subtle and intense kind. Infused as it is by insight, it is as though there is nothing but that peace. It is truly universal and utterly immovable. It is not just an absence of conflict. It has a magnitude and a solidity all of its own. Since it partakes of the nature of reality itself, no kind of disturbance can affect it in any way. Through cultivating metta, you lay a strong foundation for the development of insight. In other words, the more adequate to reality your emotional responses become, the closer you are to insight. In the Mahayana, this fully realized metta is called Mahamaitri. Maha means great or higher, and Maitri is the Sanskrit equivalent to metta. So this is metta made great, made into its ultimate, enlightened form. Mahamaitri represents a Buddha's or Bodhisattva's response to the reality of sentient beings, though that response is not quite emotion as we understand it. For one thing, it is suffused with a clear and rational awareness. Sentient beings are suffering, so what reason can there possibly be not to feel sympathy? How can I not feel compassion? How can I not try to help them? In a completely healthy person, feeling and thinking are virtually identical. You think and feel at the same time. There is no gap. But in most people, thought and feeling are distinct and even alienated from each other. If our thinking is over-objective to the point of being calculating, while our feeling is over-subjective to the point of being sentimental, our inclination will be to shrink from that over-objective thought back into that over-subjective feeling. D.H. Lawrence refers to the activity of thought as man in his wholeness wholly attending, which brings out the integrated, emotionally alive quality of the awareness we should aim for in our intellectual life. William Blake describes the relationship between reason and emotion in another way. Reason, he says, is the bound or outward circumference of energy, the bounding or limiting factor which is necessary if the expression of energy is not to degenerate into formlessness and muddle. So reason is what gives emotion its form. Significantly, it is not imposed from without by force, so as to cramp or constrict the emotion. It grows with the emotion, enabling it to express itself and body itself forth in beauty and truth. Likewise, when we generate metta and compassion, this involves mental, rational activity, not just feeling. We deliberately prepare the appropriate conditions from which we know that the feeling will arise. For example, we call to mind images of the people towards whom we want to direct love and happiness. Metta is the synthesis of reason and emotion, right view and skillful action, unobstructed spiritual vision, and the bliss of a warm and expansive heart. Perhaps the earliest, and certainly one of the most outstanding examples of the Buddha's teaching on metta, is to be found in one of the earliest surviving scriptures of the Pali Canon, the Karinaya Metta Sutta. Scholars have determined that the collection of teachings called the Sutta Nipata, from which the Karinaya Metta Sutta is drawn, is in large part an early scripture, but by no means entirely so, containing a good deal of comparatively late material. It has also been established that the Brahma Viharas are not only early but also central teaching in the Buddha's dispensation. The sutta occurs twice in the Pali Canon, once in the Sutta Nipata as the Metta Sutta, and once in the Kudakapatha, where it is given the title that has become its more popular name, the Karinaya Metta Sutta. The form of the sutta is not a prosaic discourse, but a series of stanzas composed in quantitative measure, that is, in lines of a fixed number of syllables. Perhaps we could even think of it as a poem inspired by an intense experience of metta. The text consists of just 10 verses. To begin with, it refers to the goal to be pursued and the clear-sighted and healthy ambition that one needs to pursue it. It goes on to set out the general moral character required as a basis for the development of metta. Following this, we are introduced to the specifics of how to practice the metta bhavana meditation, with a suggestion in the 7th verse of the degree of intensity to be achieved in our experience of metta. Finally, the sutta sets out the fruits of the training, indicating the close connection between the cultivation of metta and the development of insight into the nature of reality. The translation we are using, which is just one of the very many that have been made, is by Sadatissa. Before we look at it in detail, line by line, word by word, you could perhaps read it through to yourself a few times. As I said, the text is really a kind of poem and, as with the reading of all poetry, but especially such meaningful poetry, just reading it is a kind of meditation, the atmosphere of which should pervade all that follows. And here is the sutta read again. The Karinaya Metta Sutta. He who is skilled in his good, who wishes to attain that state of calm, nirvana, should act thus. He should be able, upright, perfectly upright, of noble speech, gentle and humble, contented, easily supported, with few duties of light livelihood, with senses calmed, discreet, not impudent, not greedily attached to families. He should not pursue the slightest thing for which otherwise men might censure him. May all beings be happy and secure. may their hearts be wholesome. Whatever living beings there be, feeble or strong, tall, stout or medium, short, small or large, without exception, seen or unseen, those dwelling far or near, those who are born or those who are to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, nor despise any person whatsoever in any place. Let him not wish any harm to another out of anger or ill will. Just as a mother would protect her only child at the risk of her own life, even so let him cultivate a boundless heart towards all beings. Let his thoughts of boundless love pervade the whole world, above, below and across, without any obstruction, without any hatred, without any enmity. Whether he stands, walks, sits or lies down, as long as he is awake, he should develop this mindfulness. This, they say, is the noblest living here. Not falling into wrong views, being virtuous and endowed with insight, by discarding attachment to sense desires, never again is he reborn.